Hey Weirdos, I'm scheduled for jury duty this week, and well, we never know what's going to be entailed in that kind of thing, so I'm posting some Dark Archives episodes to use until my civic duty is done.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
A terribly loud click was heard by all, followed by muffled but piercing screams as fresh blood started to trickle out of the box, running down and soaking into the neck of the woman's shift. Her body shook so violently that leaves dropped from the tree that she was tied to, and birds flew squawking away in all directions.
"The will is done! The witch will see no more into the hearts of men," intoned the zealous witchfinder. "She will be led by the nose to her place of death. Let this be a warning to all."
I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the show. And if you're listening on the radio or on a streaming station, be sure to subscribe to the podcast too. I upload episodes 7 days a week. And if you're already a member of our Weirdo family, please take a moment and invite a friend, family member, or coworker to listen in. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and more, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up in this episode, it's a special Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness, where I reach back into the archives and bring out some dark and strange stories you might not have heard yet, as they are from several years ago. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into this Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness.
It was a normal night, several years ago. I was staying with my grandparents, and it was time to go to bed, so I did. I don't know the exact time, but it was in the middle of the night. I awoke to see a green ball floating in the living room. The room was cold. Being pretty young at the time, I didn't know what it was, but I knew that it wasn't something normal. I tried to wake up my grandfather, but it was no use. He slept through my attempts at trying to wake him up. I looked back at the green ball floating in the entryway to my grandmother's room of old stuff. It didn't move, but it had an odd, ominous glow to it. I walked slowly into my grandmother's room while keeping a sharp eye on the orb. I can't help but feel as if it were staring at me. I slept in my grandmother's room for the night. I checked the room out the following day. There was an old picture in the place where the orb had been. No one could explain what I saw. Even I can't seem to find a reasonable explanation. I think I'm a little bit sensitive to the spirit world. I've heard strange stories my whole life. I've seen objects move around. I've also had some very strange dreams, but this happened to me a few years ago when I was with my last girlfriend. My girlfriend had this speaker system, kind of like a boombox that works either plugged in or with batteries. We were listening to music one evening, and the speaker made this error sound when we turned it on. I got a bit freaked out, but my girlfriend told me it's normal and that it does it every time you turn it on. It was just a buzz. Then we went out for a while, and when we came back, we decided to watch a movie. We had to take the boombox plug out of the power socket so we could get power for the television. My girlfriend went ahead and took the plug from the socket and lifted the speaker up. It made the strange error sound while unplugged. At that point, I freaked out completely, but it hadn't hit my girlfriend yet. She slowly realized it and checked the batteries as the speaker made another error sound. There was just one battery, even though the speaker required two to work. So she slowly put the speaker back on the ground and came to sit with me on the bed. I asked her, did she even realize what just happened? We later tested the battery. It had no power in it. The old road from Ashford to Faversham in Kent passes by the tiny hamlet of Sheldwich, signposted, but blink and you will miss it as you drive by. On moonlit nights, this is probably a good thing. Few will pass this way on foot at the full moon, and those who do so have been considered by the local folk to be foolhardy or, at best, deeply in need of help. You see, Sheldwich holds secrets, secrets of fear, wicked doings, and an age-old mystery. The village is not big, but is pretty, and it's set around an attractive village green, a space which in summer is used for community activities such as local school sports, car boot sale flea markets, and amateur cricket matches. It is a pretty and quiet place. As with all Kentish villages and British rural farming communities, May Day and the harvest at the end of summer are of great importance and are celebrated in various ways, including the usual harvest festival celebrations at the nearby church. You may even see the local Morris men, arrayed in their colorful costumes and prancing around to old folk tunes, another ancient tradition from the pagan past. Or perhaps the medieval Maypole celebration, where children intertwine colored ribbons into a complicated plait as they dance around the tall pole. Kent is thought to be the earliest settled part of England, only 22 miles from the European mainland across the English Channel, now the world's busiest seaway and crammed with modern shipping as well as the past spirits of dead seamen. With so many early settlers arriving in the far distant and pre-Christian past from all over Europe and beyond, the remnants of paganism remain to this day, in the legends of the past, in ceremonies and dances, and in the strange objects which can be found around the country. For example, Kit's Cody, a small stone structure in the style of a tiny Druid Stonehenge, or the many burial mounds and ancient carved sarsen stones that abound in this southern country. Even many of the hedges and paths predate historical record. Stone Age man has left his mark here very well. Throughout history, Kent has been of the utmost importance in keeping the country safe from invasion and is littered with beautiful and ancient castles, the most important of which is Dover, from the walls of which the cliffs and hills of France can be clearly seen across the water. Our village churches are largely from the Norman period, almost 1,000 years old in some cases, but still standing erect and stable, ready for another 1,000 years of prayer. Sheldwich, then, is typical of the small rural hamlets which litter Kent, but in some ways is far more unique and strange. One could almost say weird. It is said that the village green in past times has seen strange sacrifices to the pagan gods of the earth and sun to ensure good harvests in the growing seasons or to encourage wealth for the village. Sacrificial structures would have been constructed, used in the worship of now unremembered gods, and burnt as offerings to placate those gods from sending the expected poor harvests that often brought famine in their wake. And in later days of witchcraft and wizardry, the suspected were burnt at the stake or left in the stocks to die a humiliating and slow death as they were tormented by the good folk of Sheldwich upon the same pastoral green. A century or two later, felons, thieves, and highwaymen would be hung here at the village gallows or left to die in the iron basket of death at the gibbet. Is it any surprise, then, that this pretty village green, as sweet as it looks today, is also shrouded with evil and rampant with ghosts and ghouls from all periods? It is said that an old lady still haunts under the grove of trees beside the green, her eyes piercing through the darkness as she wanders towards unsuspecting folk. It is only when she is a few yards away that she turns her head and the true state of her visage is seen. The flesh burnt and shrunken from the great heat of fire, and her lips shriveled, the worn and yellowed teeth shining in the grin of death as her claw-like hands reach out towards her victim. Is she still trying to find someone? Or is she seeking to avenge her untimely and horrific death at the stake? Who is this old woman still seeking something in death? Nobody these days can say, but she seems destined to walk here forever, bringing fear to the village and those she meets on her moonlit walks, and leaving those unfortunate enough to run into her, trembling from the experience. At the junction of the two roads that join at the village green, history tells us that the gibbet was once set up, its rusted wrought iron cage a warning to travelers and the unwelcome. To be caged alive, hanging in the cold wind and rain, or suffering in the live heat of a summer day when the sun-hot iron would burn into the skin of the victim with searing pain, must have been torture beyond comprehension. The gibbet area seems to be haunted not by one, but by at least three different ghosts, each appearing at specific times of the year and each with their own special characteristics. The saddest of these is a young boy, clad in rags and often seen sitting at the exact site of where the gibbet once set. Tears stream down his tiny white face as he clutches what seems to be a loaf of bread against his chest. If you should see this ghost, he will reach out to you imploringly and mouth unspoken words as you pass him by. His eyes will catch yours, and it seems impossible to lose his stare. Do not be afraid of this figure, however. The village people in the last century named him William, after a small lad interred in the village churchyard. William stole bread, it seems, to feed his starving family and suffered on the gibbet for it, being made an example to other poor people and children. It is not known if the ghost is that of the boy in the churchyard. The name just seemed to fit, and so was given. A more unusual specter at the old gibbet site is that of a young man, most often seen before summer storms, when lightning flashes momentarily brighten the green. He has the appearance of being wild and untamed, an aggressive stance often being described by those who have seen him, along with a shabby appearance and long, matted hair. It is reported that objects, usually stones and rocks, but sometimes other items like conkers and nuts, are seemingly thrown at those who see this apparition. Sometimes people have reported being pushed over from behind or having been suddenly punched in the neck or back. This is not a ghost to mess with. Most of the villagers agree. The punches often leave a physical bruise. The other spirit is most often seen in the deep winter months. He stands writhing about and clasping his hands together as though chained to an invisible post or stake. He is known to speak softly to the persons who see him in an unknown dialect, possibly Latin, or to wail and scream on the wild winter nights when snow falls in the village. A feeling of deep unhappiness is reported by those who have seen this ghost. Across the green, a small old house has its own haunting spirit. I will not describe the house, but will say that carved into a wooden lintel above a door, a spell against witchcraft can still be seen. It is not there to keep witches out, but this one, more unusually, to keep a witch confined inside, with a spell to kill if the doorway is passed through from inside. The door has not been used for many years, so perhaps the spell is much too powerful and might still be working after the 3 centuries that have passed since it was engraved on the lintel above.
There's more of this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness still to come. Hey Weirdos, Weird Darkness has been nominated for a podcast award in 4 categories this year: Storyteller Drama, Society and Culture, True Crime, and the coveted People's Choice category. You can vote for Weird Darkness in all 4 categories at the same time by visiting podcastawards.com. Once you sign up to vote, you'll find all 4 categories in the left-hand column. People's Choice at the very top, and then bottom left-hand column for the remaining 3 when you scroll down. While it's still on your mind right now, please, go vote! Only you, my weirdo family, can help Weird Darkness become an award-winning podcast this year. Go to podcastawards.com and vote for Weird Darkness in the Storyteller Drama category, the Society and Culture category, the True Crime category, and the People's Choice category. And thank you, weirdo family, for nominating and voting for Weird Darkness. Every month, 1 email newsletter subscriber is chosen at random to win a Weird Darkness prize pack. You could be my next winner. Sign up for the newsletter for free at WeirdDarkness.com.
The sheer horror of this Kentish story forbids me to actually name the quiet village where the following took place in around about the year 1620. However, if I was to treat this as a solvable clue for the curious and intellectual researcher into the paranormal, I would describe the village as having a traditional English woman's name followed by her boiled loin of pork. That is the only clue. A map may suffice to locate the actual place, which itself is close to a prominent castle. About the late 1500s and into the 1620s, a zealot lived in this small community. His wanton need for control of people of the village led him to declare himself the official witch finder for the local area, and like all bullies, both before and since, he ruthlessly exploited the people's fears of the unknown and evil, and of him. The local folk bought his favor with gifts of produce and money, and he grew rich from his way of working one family against another in order to increase his wealth. As with the pious in general, his ideas and belief were considered by him to be fact, and anything or anyone who questioned them was said to be working against him, and therefore they were a devil's disciple. As he grew rich and more powerful, the people of the village became poor and submerged by his presence and will. If one did not agree or could not give payment, those persons would find troubles piled upon them, the worst of which was a charge of witchcraft and all this implied. The witchfinder would always find the proof of witchcraft. Maybe a cat had followed the person, or a frog had been found crucified with twigs, a baby cried in a strange language, or a single beam of sunlight had lit up his victim's house while others were in the shade. As there was no argument allowed, the self-appointed witchfinder always had his way, and the people of the village and the other hamlets around always did his will. A young woman moved into another village about 10 miles away. She was poor, as her husband had died, leaving her with 2 small children. She was told to prepare gifts for the zealot when he visited to collect his tithe. But having very little to feed herself and her children, she refused to comply, staying away in her small hovel home close to the river at Chilham, where she kept a goat for milk. She had the unfortunate condition of having a large black mole that had grown on her forehead since childhood. It was high between her eyes and gave her the appearance of being trioptic, like having a third eye just visible under her fringe of hair. The witchfinder, on hearing that the girl would not provide the gift he required, asked more about her and was told of her strange appearance. Of course, a witch, he decided, and took it upon himself to rid the village of her, to make an example to the others in the village and round about. Her refusal to give some tithes to him sealed her fate. He devised a plan. As being a bully, he did not want to have personal involvement in the crime he was to commit against the strong-willed and quite innocent young woman. If no human hand was involved in her actual chastisement, he decided, then nobody could be accused of doing her harm. With the help of the village coffin maker and also a local blacksmith, he devised a strange and weird box which he proclaimed would be controlled by a higher judge. The box was sturdily constructed from holy alder wood by the coffin maker, and the blacksmith contributed some curious ironwork controlled by powerful springs. The poor young woman was called to trial by the witchfinder, and so was instantly found guilty. However, to prove her final guilt or innocence to the folks of Chilham, a practical trial was arranged. The trial concerned the evil box. Drilled into the face of the box were two tiny holes, spaced for human eyes to focus through. The trial was simple. The box would be placed upon the woman's head, and looking through the tiny holes, she would be asked to identify a noted chapter of the best-known book in the village. The village people only had one book, as the villagers were generally illiterate workers. Only the educated could read and write. The book was kept in the castle chapel. If she could identify the text, the accused would be dismissed as innocent. Otherwise, she would be cast out of the villages around and left to forage in the forests for food, the witchfinder told the people. Asked to take the test to prove her innocence, the woman agreed. She had been taught by nuns and knew how to read, not only in English but in Latin too. She would pass the test. To keep her still while the box was fitted, her hands were tied to a rowan tree, which grew near the village square. I'm told that the tree is still there, but I have never seen it myself, although others claim that they have. The box was carefully hung in front of her face, and the great book was placed upon an eagle lectern, borrowed from the castle chapel. She was asked to enter the box and identify the text at her will, and so, giving a sigh and looking with a smile at her two young children, she stooped and pushed her head upwards into the wooden box to gain her freedom. A terrible loud click was heard by all, followed by muffled but piercing screams as fresh blood started to trickle out of the box, running down and soaking into the neck of the woman's shift. Her body shook so violently that leaves dropped from the tree that she was tied to, and birds flew squawking away in all directions.
"The will is done. The witch will see no more into the hearts of men," intoned the zealous witchfinder. "She will be led by the nose to her place of death. Let this be a warning to all."
A tall man is reported to have been standing at the back of the crowd as the test was made. A stranger to the village, he turned and left on foot as the box was lifted from the head of the screaming victim, her eyes now struck out and bleeding profusely as she collapsed in pain. Records state that a clipe of iron was then made fasted to her nose, and when she recovered from her faint, she was led away to the castle dungeon by a rope tied to a clip as one would lead an ox. She was never seen alive again. Within a month, the witchfinder himself was dead, his head crushed by a large and ancient stone of great weight. How this happened is not known, but the stone can still be seen to this day in his home village. It would likely need 5 or 10 strong men to lift it. About this time, too, the tall stranger returned and took the 2 young children under his care. He became rich working as a draper in Canterbury and employed many folk from the village of Chilham during the winter months, dyeing and cutting cloth for his shop close to the cathedral. The children, too, grew up to be worthy citizens of the town. The boy first as a young clerk and later an important lawyer, the girl as a teacher of girls at the school and later as a trainer of wet nurses and midwives for the town. The box itself was retained at the castle for many years as a strange curiosity. Inside and unseen was a mechanism which worked much like a mousetrap, releasing instantly as the head was fully inserted to look out of the holes, driving a sprung iron plate which shot 2 heavy bodkins into the eyes of the victim. A victim who thought she would be freed on reading the chosen text. It is believed that the box was purchased at a village auction in the 19th century and transferred to a private museum in Kent, where it was displayed along with an eclectic variety of strange objects from around the world. It is not known if it still exists, although I am told that the museum still does, within the confines of a private estate. Chilham is to this day a tiny but beautiful village, built around a market square with the castle on one side and the church on the other. Tourists abound, enjoying tea and cakes, within a few yards of where the terrible torture took place. The hill from the square drops down to the meadow where once a hovel gave shelter to a woman and her children by the slow meandering river, a woman with an unfortunate mole that sealed her fate and took her life. The Witchfinder's own village never prospered. It remained a tiny hamlet on the way to London, close to the Pilgrim's Way. Today, it is being quickly engulfed by hundreds of new houses, the village failing more now as a major road bypasses it. Few travelers stop. There is little of interest there. Within a few years, it will become like the many forgotten villages of London, just an area name on a map crammed with streets, its heart pulled out of its ancient memories, faded by the passing of time and demise of those who could remember the old stories. However, it will remain haunted. Haunted by the well-known specter of a woman, stumbling blindly as she feels her way along the walls of the old village houses in the pitch of night, searching to find the witchfinder and shrieking for mercy for her children, as her sightless eye sockets, still running with blood, stare at anyone unfortunate enough to meet her on their own journey home to the pleasant warmth of family life.
Keep listening. There's more of this special Darkhives episode of Weird Darkness on the way. If you or someone you know struggles with depression or dark thoughts, I'd like to recommend the Hope in the Darkness page at WeirdDarkness.com. There, I've gathered resources to help fight depression with the 7 Cups app, connecting you with people who've also struggled with depression and are there to lift you up, even professional listeners there to listen at all hours of the day. If you're having dark thoughts of harming yourself or worse, there's the Suicide Prevention Lifeline that you can either call or chat online with anytime 24/7. The folks at ifred.org are doing what they can with research and education on depression to give us the tools we need to fight against it in the days ahead. And if you feel a lack of hope in your life, take the 30-Day Global Hope Challenge. It's absolutely free. You can do it alone or with a friend or with a group. And after 30 days, you'll have a better understanding of how to build hope in your own life and in the life of others. You can find all of this on the Hope in the Darkness page at WeirdDarkness.com. If you like Weird Darkness, you'll want to also listen to some of the free audiobooks I've narrated, with titles by Stephen King, H.P. Lovecraft, Charles Dickens, and more. Check out all the audiobooks I've narrated on the audiobooks page at WeirdDarkness.com.
If you've seen the movie The Night of the Living Dead, you know zombies are walking dead suddenly coming back to life. In the movie, survivors barricade themselves in an old farmhouse in an attempt to remain safe from these flesh-eating monsters. But how realistic is the scenario in real life? The term zombie can be traced to Haitian folklore, where a zombie is a dead body reanimated through various methods, most commonly magic. Zombie is a word of West African origin. In the voodoo religion of West Africa, a zombie was also a snake god. During the 18th and early 19th centuries, many slaves were brought to Haiti and other parts of the Caribbean. They brought their religious beliefs and practices with them, and the term zombie was first recorded in English in 1819. The stories of zombies spread through the U.S. and Europe, and during the 20th century, the subject became so popular that many fictional movies and horror books were produced. Archaeologists have found many mysterious skulls that some suggest are a sign that ancient people fought and survived a zombie apocalypse, or at least were terrified of living dead. Archaeologists have unearthed detached skulls at many Stone Age sites in Europe and the Near East sites. Several skulls buried underneath an ancient settlement in Syria were found detached from their bodies with their faces smashed in. This archaeological discovery is a scientific mystery with many unanswered questions. Strangely, many of the 10,000-year-old skulls appear to have been separated from their spines long after their bodies had already begun to decompose. Evidence suggests that the skulls were exhumed and detached from their bodies several years after originally being buried. It was then that they were smashed in and reburied separate from their bodies. Most of the skulls belonged to adult males between 18 and 30 years old. One, belonging to a child, was left intact. One was smashed to pieces. The remaining nine lacked facial bones. Why would this skull-smashing ritual be performed so long after individuals had died? Did they only pose a threat to the living long after their original burial and death? Who were these beings that had been dead for so many years and were still feared? The post-mortem violence suggests young men were seen as carrying a particular threat, and destroying their facial structures may have been a way of destroying the individual's identities, according to researchers at the University of Manchester, UK. At the same time, researchers point out that taking away facial identity could be a way of separating the dead from the living and also could help deal with grief. According to zombie mythology, the walking dead are hungry for the flesh of the living, and the only way to stop them is with a headshot. In many zombie movies, this involves shooting them in the cranium. The frontal lobe must be damaged because zombies act on base impulses, like pursuing and eating other people. Other brain damage accounts for the lack of motor coordination and general poor manners, according to the Zombie Research Society. How could Stone Age people know the only way to kill a zombie was by damaging the cranium? Did our ancestors really fight and survive a zombie apocalypse? Juan José Ibáñez of the Spanish National Research Council in Barcelona suggests a less dramatic explanation. He believes that Stone Age cultures believed dead young men were a threat to the world of the living. He says that our ancestors thought they could absorb the strength of the dead young men by performing the smashing skull ritual. This is the reason why a majority of the skulls were from young men. On the other hand, it is also possible Stone Age people feared that the dead rise from their graves, and the only way to stop this from happening was by smashing the skull. This suggests that fears about the walking dead may go back all the way to the Stone Age. Can a zombie apocalypse actually happen? Most scientists do not consider a zombie apocalypse to be very realistic, but there are various parasites that are extremely dangerous and can damage our brain and blood, and a global infectious disease outbreak is highly possible. Reports of the Zika virus have been widespread recently. Zika virus disease is caused by a virus transmitted by Aedes mosquitoes. Like the 2014 Ebola epidemic and numerous fictional zombie viruses, the disease seems to have spread much faster and farther than any treatment or containment efforts. Zika has also been linked to Guillain-Barré syndrome and microcephaly, a neurodevelopmental disorder that can severely impair the development of the brain or central nervous system. In northern Uganda, approximately 3,000 children have become afflicted with what has been called nodding disease, or more colloquially, zombie disease. It only affects children who later create a fire and then launch themselves into it. Research conducted by a student at the University of Leicester suggests a zombie apocalypse would wipe out humankind in just 100 days. After zombie infection spread, less than 300 people would remain alive globally. A zombie invasion is still distinctly fictional by comparison to real-life public health challenges. However, many people still fear a zombie outbreak, and there are even online manuals how to survive a zombie apocalypse. No matter what the truth might be, one thing is clear. Zombies have always been a source of fascination and fear. It should be mentioned that zombies should not be confused with the walking dead syndrome. There are a number of people who actually believe they are dead. The Cotard delusion, also known as the walking corpse syndrome, is a rare mental disorder that convinces people that they are walking, rotting corpses with missing organs. Some patients suffering from walking corpse syndrome have died of starvation since they deprived themselves of food, thinking that they were already dead. The patients also have a tendency to attempt suicide and harm themselves.
Thanks for listening to this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. And if you've not done so already, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. I upload episodes 7 days a week. If you want to reach out to me, you can email me anytime with your questions or comments at darren@weirddarkness.com. That's D-A-R-R-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and you can join the Weirdos Facebook group on the Contact Social page at WeirdDarkness.com. While on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, click on Tell Your Story to email it to me. Or tell your story by phone by calling the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. I'm Darren Marler. Thanks for joining me in this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. You've bolted the doors, locked the windows, turned off the lights, And now, all you need before listening to Weird Darkness is a mug of Weird Dark Roast Coffee to keep those ghostly chills at bay. Weird Dark Roast Coffee has deep notes of cocoa, caramel, and a touch of sinister sweetness. This is an exclusive coffee that I selected specifically for you, my weirdo family. Weird Dark Roast is not available in stores, coffee houses, mad scientist labs, or even the dark web, but you can find it at WeirdDarkness.com. Use the promo code WEIRD and you won't even have to pay for delivery on your first order. Weird Dark Roast Coffee. Find the link and grab a bag now for yourself at WeirdDarkness.com.